Today I want to begin a new series of sermons that will extend for the next few weeks up till Lent begins on portrayals of Jesus Christ in the Gospel of John. In the next few weeks I want to try to sketch in, focus, the Johannine, the Gospel of John's portrayal, understanding, the sketching in of who Jesus of Nazareth is as we see him in the Gospel of John. And today I've selected a very simple and forthright encounter that occurs toward the beginning of our Lord's ministry, following a very brief trip to Jerusalem. Jesus comes back to Galilee, and so he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And at Capernaum there was an official whose son was ill, and when he heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went and begged him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. Jesus therefore said to the man, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." This sort of general statement to a man with a specific problem. The official said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." An intensely specific answer to a general statement. And Jesus had said to him, "Go. Your son will live." The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went away. And as he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was living. So then he asked them the hour that he began to mend. And they said to him, "Yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him." That'd be 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The father knew that this was the hour when Jesus said to him, "Your son will live." And he himself believed in all his household. And then John makes this last little cryptic comment, "And this now was the second sign that Jesus did when he came from Judea to Galilee." Next week, we'll look at that first sign and try to grapple with the meaning of these signs. But today, let's take a look briefly at this sign. It seems to me this narrative points up in a very moving way. It's moving to us because it's so personal. We all are immediately involved in the passage. Anyone who ever had a son or a daughter is caught up in this passage instantly. And it seems to me this very brief little episode that John records for us points up at least three of the vital emphases that are present in our Lord's ministry. If you were to take the ministry of Jesus Christ and try to understand what are the vital or the important emphases, Jesus does things, if you were to try to understand how it is that our Lord carries out his ministry, what are the things that are important to him, how does he relate to the human scene, it seems to me this narrative points up three vital emphases that are present in our Lord's ministry. And I'd like to briefly, on this Communion Sunday, sketch them in. First, our Lord's ministry, from beginning to end, was person-oriented. Now, in this narrative, what dominates above every other thing is the individual encounter of one man and Jesus of Nazareth. And John, the disciple who writes the account, just stands back in sort of a reverent distance and just records the encounter. That's the thing that's most devastating, the most impressive thing in this account, is just one man and Jesus of Nazareth. As a matter of fact, even our Lord's roadblock reply to the official sharpens up the personal orientation. Remember, the man said, "Help me, my son is sick at the point of death." And Jesus said, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." Now, that's a general statement, sort of a general truth, a theological observation. That answer that our Lord gives, which poses a kind of roadblock to the man, our Lord does this often in his ministry. He will erect a kind of temporary roadblock as people are confronting him with need. But the impact of that roadblock is that it just all the more sharpens up the intensity and the personalness of this encounter. The man comes back to Jesus after he says that. In no way tries to argue with our Lord's point. He just says to him in almost a note of desperation, "Help me before my son dies. Come down, sir, before he dies." The man from Capernaum at that point becomes very understandable to us. We empathize with him. Before, at the beginning of the account, he's an official. He's a leader in Capernaum. At that point in the account, he becomes just an ordinary person like we are. with profound human need. So even our Lord's roadblock sharpens this personal nature in the encounter. Not only that, but this encounter poses a major question for all time. As a matter of fact, our Old Testament Psalm, Psalm 6, also poses the same question in the great Psalm from David as he cries out for help. And that question, which stretches through the Bible, and in our Lord's ministry we have a decisive answer to it, but the question is posed, does mere man, an ordinary man, whether he's an official from Capernaum, or just whether he's David the king, or whether he's a beggar on the side of the road crying out, "Oh, son of David, have mercy upon me," whoever he is, you and I in the 20th century, we're included in this question too. Does man have a claim upon God? Is there any point at which God will answer man or must answer man? This is a great and historic theological question. It stretches back into the Old Testament. It goes through the New Testament. Does man, do you, have a claim upon God? That's a very important question when you think of the sheer numbers of people. When you think of the great and vast amount of population in the world, than even more so today. That's one of those questions that becomes more complex, more difficult as the ages go on. As population increases, the question increases. Couldn't God possibly have an interest in man when you consider the immense numbers of men? And with that increase in number, the apparent insignificance of man also increases. And that's really a question posed in this encounter. And in this passage, as throughout the New Testament, our Lord shows his own answer. When a man needs God, he has a hold on him. Now that's made clear in this encounter. It's the same conclusion David comes to in his psalm. When he cries out his overwhelming need. Remember David said, "Oh, turn, O Lord, save my life, deliver me. My soul is surely troubled, but thou, O Lord, how long will you wait? Now turn, deliver me." And then David gives an answer here. I'll refer to it in just a moment. This text shows our Lord's answer to that question. When we need God, we have a hold on him. And this is true for two reasons. In effect, man has a twofold claim upon God, and the man from Capernaum discovered it. The first is the basis of our need. Our Lord made it clear over and over in his ministry. The beginning of the book of Luke, in Luke there are three encounters which highlight this. Jesus said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but I am the physician. I have come for those who are in need of a physician." He says this to the Pharisees, in effect saying, "If you're sick, I've come for you. If you have a great need, I'm here. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. If, on the other hand, you're well, then you have no need of me." Now, our Lord puts that negatively, but the positive point is luminously clear. And then a little later, to the Pharisees, he tells a parable. Three little parables, actually. Parables of the 99 sheep and the one that was lost, of the 10 sheep, or the 10 coins and the one that was lost, and of the two boys and the one that was lost. And in that parable, our Lord says to the Pharisees and to all those who are listening, if you feel lost, then you have a claim on me. As a matter of fact, the shepherd leaves the 99 sheep that are safe and goes to find the one that's lost. I have come for those who feel their lostness. But on the other hand, if you feel found and don't feel any sense of lostness, then you have no claim on me. The point that our Lord makes in his parables, that now is being made here in a living experience by the man from Capernaum, is that if you have a great need, then you have a claim on me. I'm the physician who's come for those who are sick. But there's a profounder reason for the claim. You have a claim on God on the basis of his character. And really, in the last analysis, that's the only real claim we have. David saw this. Listen to the psalm. I read part of it to you. Turn, O Lord, and save my life. Deliver me for the sake of thy steadfast love. And that's the turning point of David's psalm. He says, I have an overwhelming need. That's the opening of the psalm. I feel completely surrounded. I feel pitiable. I feel helpless, surrounded by my enemies. And then David says, turn, O Lord, and save my life. Deliver me for the sake of thy steadfast love. What David is doing is this. He is saying, I'm claiming now your nature, God. I know who you are. I know something about your love. And on the basis of your love, I ask you to be true to your own character. And as I see it, this is what the man from Capernaum does. Jesus says to him, After he asks the first question, come and help me, my son is sick, Jesus says, well, unless you see signs and wonders, you won't believe. A roadblock. And then this man comes back to Jesus and puts a claim on our Lord's love and says, sir, help me. My son's dying. And Jesus says, your son will live. What the man from Capernaum does is he puts a claim upon the nature of Christ, his love. And men and women, from that moment on, we have had the right to put a claim on God's love. Paul has a marvelous little sentence in 2 Timothy where he says, though we may deny him and though we may be unfaithful to him, he will not deny himself because he has to be true to his own nature. God must be true to his own character. That above all. And this is sort of the bedrock orientation of our Lord's ministry. We have a right to put a claim upon God to be true to himself, his love. He cares. And that person orientation, that is the sort of grassroots of our Lord's ministry. Let me give you another orientation, though, that's also true in Jesus' ministry that we see in this encounter. This text also shows us that our Lord's ministry is situation-oriented as well as person-oriented. As man, as a person, has a claim upon God's love, and our Lord cares about the person. So, this text shows our Lord's sensitivity to the situation, to the setting, to the context in which the man from Capernaum lived. In the encounter with the man from Capernaum, our Lord helps him in a concrete way. He helps him in terms of his own particular family need, the setting in which he lived. Our Lord does not spiritualize or idealize the man's situation. The man is not given a sort of spiritual solution, an escape from reality. But he's helped in a concrete and definite way. In this sense, Jesus is the true materialist, in the very best sense of the word. I'm using now materialist in this sort of philosophical sense, that Jesus sees us in our holistic relationships. He sees us not only as a spiritual reality, but as a material reality. This man is not only one who believes. Notice that the opening, our Lord confronts him with the spiritual, general truth. Unless you see signs, you will not believe. That seems to be a sort of spiritual truth. But the man is also not only a man capable of spiritual experience, he's also a man who has relationships. He is a son, he has wife, he has children, and it's one of those sons who's desperately ill that is the particular crisis, is the context in which that man is living at that moment. And our Lord recognizes that context. Jesus does this in all of his healing ministry. It's one of the great important theological parts of our Lord's healing ministry. When Jesus heals us physically in the New Testament, he is grappling with the sort of context in which we live, as well as our sort of spirit, treating us as if we were just those who make spiritual decisions or intellectual decisions abstracted from our historical existence. Jesus, what he does is practical, particular, concrete. He treats this man in a whole, as a whole creature. In this case, a man who has a son. Now, it seems to me the unmistakable implication for us as his disciples in our time is that we must be situation-oriented too. Just as in the unmistakable implication of the first orientation of our Lord's ministry, his person-centeredness, we have to be person-centered. We have an instinct for persons. And so we have an instinct for situations, for the context. As Jesus saw people in their whole relationships, so we must also see people as whole people in a whole context. This becomes vividly clear. No man lives in isolation from his setting. And therefore, it is right for us, as disciples of Jesus, to recognize man in this whole setting, to work for the wholeness of the man's life. But our Lord here is setting out, charting out his own ministry. And his ministry is person-oriented. And now, at the same time, unwilling to abstract this man from Capernaum and treat him as one isolated individual, just to deal with him and what he is, he also instinctively, our Lord, relates to that man's setting. The setting for that man is different than the setting for other men in the New Testament, but the setting for that man is a specific, concrete need down at Capernaum, in a little hospital where his son's dying. And Jesus is sensitive to that need. There's a third orientation in our Lord's ministry too. And we see that also in this text. In a beautiful sort of, almost as a PS in the text, we find this third orientation come through. In the midst of that man's crisis, not only dealing with the man as a person, dealing with his situation, but our Lord also raises the large questions of faith and meaning. Because Jesus Christ is meaning-oriented, our Lord's whole ministry is meaning-oriented. Jesus never treats us just as men and women who have specific or concrete needs, whether they're contextual or just individual, but our Lord is always grappling with the deeper reasons. He's always grappling and ministering to us in terms of who we are and what life means. Let me show you this account. It's very interesting. As soon as our Lord tells the man from Capernaum, "Your son will live," listen to the text. The official said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus said to him, "Go, your son will live." It's interesting. The first thing Jesus says is, "Go, your son will live." He doesn't want to stay and talk theology or talk the meaning of life at this point. And John gives a very sparse little comment. The man believed the word, in other words, the command or the statement of hope that Jesus gave, the man believed, and then he went his way. He had to rush home. And when he's en route on the way home to find out what happened, the people meet him and they tell him that your son is all right. And then, very interestingly, according to John's text, as he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was living. So he asked them the hour when he began to mend. He was very interested in now this detail. When was it that he began to mend? You see what's happening to this man from Capernaum? When it's not enough that his son was made well, but then instantly he becomes an appetite, a curiosity begins to develop in his mind to find out when he was made well. He wants to see if he can connect what happened at Capernaum in the health of his son with his encounter with Jesus. And they said, it was the seventh hour. And the father knew that was the hour when Jesus said to him, "Your son will live." And he himself believed, and then his whole household. And John says, now, this was the second of the signs that Jesus did. At first, in the emergency, the man from Capernaum can't discuss anything. To talk at that point about the meaning of life, to talk about that point about what he's living for and what his goals are and what's the whole purpose of his historical existence, to talk at that time about this would be irrelevant to where his heart really is. He's got to get home. He's got to find out how things are at home. As a matter of fact, we don't even catch the man's name. But very soon, as soon as the servants meet him on the way and say, your son's all right, and it was at 1 o'clock that he began to mend, then we see a whole shift take place. And then this man he's eager to know the answer to the biggest of all questions. You know, this happens over and over again in our Lord's ministry. In the 9th chapter of John, Jesus heals a young boy who was blind from birth and evidently was always begging at the temple site. And our Lord rubbed the mud on the boy's face and told him to run and wash off the pool of Siloam. The young man did, and he came back seeing. Jesus doesn't really talk to the young man, doesn't give him, there's no discussion about life or meaning at that point. But when the young man comes back and his eyesight has been restored, then the young man is interested to find out the meaning and the reason for all of this. And it's in that context, following this event, that Jesus has this incredible discussion with the young man and says, "Do you believe in the prophet?" He says, "Yes, show me where he is so that I can believe in him." And Jesus says, "He who's standing here is the one." And the man believed. Jesus talks to him then about what is the source of the meaning of life. After the sort of context, after the man was grappled with, then our Lord talked meaning. Same thing happens, as you know, in the most famous of all of our Lord's miracles, the feeding of the 5,000. Following the feeding of the 5,000, our Lord discussed a far profounder truth than just bread. He talked about himself as the bread of life, a bread that would not pass away, that would not become meaningless. Now, this is basic in our Lord's ministry. It's sensitive. He grapples with us where we are. But everything that our Lord said and everything that our Lord does makes sense. And I see that symbolized by the man from Capernaum saying, "What time was the boy made well?" 1 o'clock. That's when Jesus spoke. And he begins to form connections and sees the connections between his son's health and our Lord. Our Lord shows in different and unique ways the meaning of life, the worth of people, the goal of life, everything that Jesus did, all of his acts and all of our Lord's words give us a sense of meaning. Jesus was meaning-oriented. By the way, on the last night in which our Lord was with his disciples, the Lord's Supper, have you ever thought of the Lord's Supper in the same context? The Lord's Supper has the same sort of three marks as the man from Capernaum incident. Our Lord is person-centered in the Lord's Supper, situation-centered, meaning-centered. Our Lord is sensitive to the situation. The situation for the disciples is one of conflict. They're arguing over who's going to be the greatest. Remember that the Lord's Supper occurs on Thursday night while the disciples are still flushed and are still excited. They're still bullish because on just 3 days before on Palm Sunday, they had seen a tremendous outpouring of public affection for Christ. And they are convinced that victory is around the corner. And so, consequently, in that atmosphere, they begin to argue with each other as to who is to be the greatest. Are you aware of that, that when they went into the upper room on Thursday night of Holy Week, just a few minutes before our Lord would be betrayed into the hands of his enemies, just a few minutes before that, they were arguing over who was going to reign, who was going to be the leader in this movement. That's how sure they were of success. And that's the setting. And as you take a look at the Lord's Supper, you see our Lord grapples sensitively with that setting. He takes the towel in his hand and he washes their feet. That's the significance of the foot washing of our Lord. To confront the disciples with a whole new view of greatness. The greatness that goes the route of humiliation. And Jesus is to prepare them for a humiliation that will stagger their imagination. Our Lord is situation-oriented, and the Lord's Supper is set within a meaningful and real situation. At the same time, our Lord shows great sensitivity to the people that are there. To each one goes the bread and the wine. These are symbols of his broken body. The emphasis is on the verb. He takes the bread and he breaks it and says, "This broken bread is my life. And it's my life now given to you. All of you eat of it and all of you drink of it. It's for you." The Lord's Supper is a magnificent event in which our Lord confirms our individual worth by giving us something to us individually that we can take and hold and place into our own mouths to eat. The symbol of personal identification. He washed their feet, then he gave to them the bread and the wine. And it's meaning-oriented. Our Lord didn't just give them a ritual or a rite which they could practice and make use of through the centuries and not really understand its significance. But our Lord interpreted the meaning of it all. "This is my body broken for you. This do in remembrance of me. As often as you eat this bread, till I come." And our Lord gives the great word of hope that I have something I'm doing. I'm going to fulfill this humiliation. I'm going to, this broken bread, this spent blood, this life given in your behalf, I'm going to regain. I'm going to regather. And there's going to be a victory. And as a result of this victory, here is the healing of the nations. As a result of this victory, this is to be a Eucharist, a Thanksgiving feast, in thanksgiving for what I've done. And so the Lord's Supper is meaning-oriented too. Everything Jesus did is person-oriented, contextual. He sees the situations in which we live, and he grants to us his meaning.